Scanlon. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The United Nations is now taking the lead on an international effort to ensure Syria eliminates its chemical weapons. But as it does, Secretary of State John Kerry is warning Syria that the threat of force is still real. It's been a wild diplomatic month regarding the U.S. and Syria, with what seemed to be an imminent U.S. military strike and the Obama administration's going back and forth over whether it needed congressional approval for this action. And there's been a lot of reflection lately on what our Constitution says about who has what authority when it comes to armed conflict. If you look at our founding document, Article 1, Section 8 plainly says that Congress has the right to declare war. Then Article 2, Section 2 says the president is commander-in-chief. In other words, he gets to wage the war that Congress has authorized. But these seemingly clear lines have often been crossed and confused. And since World War II, presidents have increasingly taken on the right to engage in armed conflicts, even if Congress objects. Today in The Exchange, murkiness over military engagement, what the Constitution says, how and why presidents often go around it, and the impact of their doing so. Let's hear from you this hour. Are there times when the president should be able to act without Congress? Are the founders' words on this outdated, given the complexity of the modern world? Or did they get it right, and today's leaders should follow their intent? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Joining us from Hanover is Linda Fowler, professor of government and the Frank J. Reagan Chair in Policy Studies at Dartmouth College. She's just finishing up a book entitled Overseeing the President in War and Peace. And Linda, welcome back. Great to have you.
It's great to be with you, Laura.
Also with us in studio, Buzz Scher, professor at UNH School of Law in Concord, chair of the International Criminal Law and Justice Program there. And Buzz, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Great to be here.
Well, and Buzz, let's just start with you and that all-important founding document. What does the Constitution say about who's in charge of what when it comes to engaging our military?
It says relatively little. What it says is short and seemingly clear. Congress gets to is the one responsible for declaring war under Article 1 of the Constitution. And under Article 2, the president effectively is the commander-in-chief and wages war. That all seems clear. The problem is, to start with, the founders of the Constitution, the writers of the Constitution did not really, weren't contemplating when they wrote this language, an offensive war, us acting first, us invading another country. They were contemplating the war they just came out of, the American Revolution, which was a defensive war, effectively. And so we don't know what war means. They never, in the context of this language, does war mean the commitment of any military troops anywhere in the world, or does it need to reach a certain length of time or certain number of troops? And that's the fundamental ambiguity of that language. It's there because they only contemplated a defensive war. But that's what presidents have been struggling with, and the Congress has been struggling with ever since.
Well, yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, they were such a new country, such a young country, such a small country, and here you have these great European powers. You know, they probably couldn't imagine that they would ever go over there and do something offensively, as
unlikely.
You said.
And the only offensive wars, that is, the United States working, acting first, that was on the radar screen were actions against Native Americans. But those were virtually all conducted by state militia. They weren't conducted by a federal army, which effectively didn't really exist other than in the temporary status during the American Revolution. So it's as with many things in the Constitution, we're trying to lend meaning to words that were written at a time that events were not contemplated that are occurring now.
Well, sure. And so let's look at those words. And Linda Fowler, to you, those words, you know, Congress has the power to declare war. It's tricky these days. So many of our military involvements in the modern era haven't been what you'd call all-out war. How have presidents, Linda, interpreted this word war in terms of the Constitution and what it says they can and can't do?
Well, I think the first place you have to look is elsewhere in Article 1, which defines Congress's powers. Congress sets the rules for the military justice system. It sets the rules for engagement. It raises and funds standing armies. It was authorized to issue letters of marque and all sorts of tactics that were involved with defense. And, of course, it authorizes and appropriates weapon systems, bases, materiel, personnel, and so forth. So I read Article 1 when looking at all of these related powers as evidence that the framers were not all that ambiguous in terms of what they thought the Congress should do. For me, the ambiguity comes not in the definition of war, but a crisis. And here you get some evidence if you look at the debate in Philadelphia in 1787, where the original language in Article 1 was the power to make war. And what little debate there is in Philadelphia that we have a written record of, you have people at the convention there saying, as George Mason did, I'm all for clogging the path to war. Because they remember their English history and their European history where England was routinely bankrupted and Europe was routinely raped and pillaged because of kings fighting pretty unnecessary war. So they were leery of executive power and thought that the king, a monarch, would be the a likely outcome of giving the president the same powers that the King of England had. Nevertheless, because of all these great powers on our borders, they were afraid that there would be an emergency. And when you think about what the communications were and that it took 2 weeks to get to New York, which was going to be the capital, they were afraid that Congress would be out of session and somebody would land on our shores. So they changed the language in Article 1 from making war to declaring war. Wow. In order to allow the president to act in emergencies. So my view of where the problem is whether a war is an emergency, something for which the president has discretion to act to protect the welfare of the people, or whether it is a discretionary war. And if you look at the post-World War II history, where presidents have gotten into trouble is with discretionary wars.
Well, certainly the word emergency is a subjective term, as we're hearing nowadays. I want to just jump in and give out the phone number, and then, Buzz, I can see you want to add in there as well. The number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, with all the recent conversation over a possible military strike against Syria, whether Congress should approve that strike or not, we're looking once again at how presidents and Congress have long tussled over constitutional war powers. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us a short email, exchange at nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Buzz, go ahead, jump in on what Linda was saying there. It's real interesting.
What's interesting is in the 20th century, this tension between Congress's power, Congress's worry, the nation's worry about too powerful a president. As the Vietnam War was ending, the Congress passed what's called the War Powers Resolution, 1973. And that added some statutory, not constitutional, but some statutory definition to the breadth, or it made an effort, is a fair way to put it, to add some statutory definition to the breadth of how a president could act without congressional authorization. To simplify it a little bit, it said the president can act when there's an imminent threat to the national security, but he needs to terminate combat in a foreign territory within 60 to 90 days unless he's got explicit congressional authorization.
But again, imminent threat, you know, people have interpreted that differently, haven't they, Buzz?
Yes, and there's an argument, my understanding, there's an argument by some in, for example, the Obama administration, and there was in the George W. Bush administration, that that does not completely define the president's authority to wage war under Article 2. That just says, in these circumstances, by statute, this is what we're going to let you do. But the argument by the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration is suggesting we still have a residue of power outside of the War Powers Resolution.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Buzz, because that comes up a lot, Linda, the War Powers Act of 1973. But correct me if I'm wrong, even before then, right, Linda, presidents were kind of stepping over the line in terms of I can take military action without consulting Congress or getting Congress's approval.
Well, let's compare Harry Truman to Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt certainly thought that there was imminent threat rising in Germany and Japan. But he felt that he could not act within the Constitution and initiate military action. The best he could do was get Congress to authorize the Selective Service Act and engage in the leisured amount of the Lend-Lease Act, where basically we supposedly lent weapons to Britain and they would give them back to us after they defeated the Nazis. So, but fast forward, at the end of World War II and the rise of the Cold War, where Harry Truman claims authority to go to the aid of our allies, South Korea, but he needs the fig leaf of the UN resolution in the Security Council, which he obtained when the Russians were not looking. And basically, it then became a treaty obligation of the United States as a member of the Security Council under the UN Charter. And then, of course, you get more and more expansive claims after Truman, which gave the rise to the wonderful phrase by the historian Schlesinger of the imperial presidency.
All right, and we'll pick up on that thread after a very short break, so stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is partnering with Stay Workplay New Hampshire to present the Rising Stars Awards. NHPR's Virginia Prescott co-hosts the event, celebrating young professionals and innovative companies throughout the state. Get your tickets for the October 7th ceremony at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Grupponi Automotive Group, providing six auto lines, including Ford, Toyota, and Honda, in a relaxed, stress-free sales environment. Driven to amaze and bow and online at Grupponi.com. And Gibson's Bookstore in downtown Concord, welcoming author and sports writer Mike Lupicus, September 27th at 6, signing QB1, inspired by the real-life Manning family of quarterbacks. Mostly cloudy for today. Chance of showers across the state. Most north of the lakes region could see some breaks of sunshine this afternoon. Highs from upper 50s north of the mountains. Mid to upper 60s for the rest of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, murkiness over military engagement. Who has what power when it comes to armed conflict? We invite you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Are there times when the president should be able to go ahead, act without Congress when it comes to a military strike or waging war? Does the founders' vision of giving Congress the right to declare war still fit our country? Is it outdated? What do you think? Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. And Linda Fowler, Buzz Scher, here's a Facebook comment that came in before the program from Porcupine, who says, our Constitution is perfectly clear. The War Powers Act gives the president the power to act for 30 days in the event we have suffered a direct attack on our country. President Obama knows this and knew it as a senator. Vice President Biden called it an impeachable act for a president to go to war without congressional approval. Because it is, please do not act like it is something deserving of debate. Now, Buzz, you were talking about the War Powers Act just before the break. Porcupine, thanks a lot for that Facebook comment.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment, but I don't think it's quite that simple. There are circumstances that have arisen even in the 21st century that cause us concern, and we don't know whether asking the president to act is engaging in war. Is what happened in Libya when we contributed to bombing, is that an act of war? Is that a waging war? That informs us as to what counts and doesn't. But part of the concern with what happens has been happening in Syria is the hangover from, for example, Rwanda, where it was clear to just about every country in the world that genocide was occurring, and no country, including the United States, acted to do anything about it. If we intervene, like Obama has suggested we should in Syria, to deal with the use of chemical weapons in theory of mass destruction, for humanitarian purposes, is that waging war? Is the nature of how we intervene count as waging war? Depend on whether it is war or not. What about, for example, the drone strikes that we've been engaging in? President Bush declared a war on terrorism. Congress authorized the Iraqi war, but didn't authorize drone strikes that both President Bush and President Obama engaged in. So I think it is more complicated than Porcupine suggested, in that there are circumstances that not all of us would count as an act of war as we understand it.
Wow, right. The drone strike is really tricky. Linda, what do you think? How does that very modern warlike action, you may not call it declaring all-out war, but how does that very modern military phenomenon fit into this constitution and history that we're talking about?
Well, I think where we're heading is the fact that many of these things are things that Congress doesn't want to deal with. Congress has war powers. It doesn't necessarily want to exercise them. Much of what we've seen in the post-World War II era is Congress basically giving its power through statute to the president by authorizing the use of discretion and a variety of things. And many people argue that the 1973 War Powers Act was in fact a weakening by Congress of its own standing under the Constitution. So, and so you have the sense that many members of Congress don't want to know. You have the sense that many members of Congress believe, rightly, that their constituents aren't interested in international affairs until things get very costly. And then, of course, the public wants Congress to apply the brakes. So I think we're not just dealing with ambiguities about what constitutes an imminent threat and what constitutes war and whether a drone attack is warfare, but we're also dealing with the fact that the public and its representatives in Congress are extremely ambivalent about executive power and when they want Congress to intervene.
And Linda's right, and I think there's an additional layer to that, which is Congress is an awfully unwieldy entity anyway, put aside this issue, but to contemplate too much active involvement of Congress in the lead up to a war, or certainly to the waging of war, which the Constitution gives to the president, is difficult. And some who are in support of presidential war powers say, look, when you're thinking about war or you're dealing with a crisis, you need one leader, you need one captain of the ship. You can't have this depending on whether we can use this as leverage to raise the debt ceiling or to get rid of Obamacare.
So Congress is basically quietly maybe saying, yeah, go ahead, President.
Well, they're situationally deferential, might be a charitable way to put it.
Here's a quote from The Atlantic, a great article by Garrett Epps, who says, many years ago, I attended a panel consisting of the legendary Barney Frank. An audience member asked Frank how Congress could take back some of its power to declare war, which had been, quote, usurped by the executive. Frank gave him a look. Usurped it, he said. Usurped it. We throw it at him. We beg him to take it. That's what you're saying, Linda. Congress really, absolutely, as much as they might complain, they don't want this.
That's right, because they know they can't target drones. They know they don't have access to intelligence. So I think the way to think about Congress is, a way of requiring deliberation about these murky situations when the nation's interests are not altogether clear. And that, I think, is what was happening in the situation with Syria. The problem is that the president was asking for authority without members of Congress having much sense of what he was going to do with it. And here the experience with Iraq is really come back to bite this president, because members of Congress thought they were authorizing a limited engagement, and then they found the nation involved in nation building. And
it was under there was certainly a perception by many that even though they authorized a limited invasion, it was under false pretenses based on the information they received. So that has made us gun shy. And what's so interesting about the Syrian circumstance, until the last week, is it was an interesting, as you put it, Linda, interesting political dance between Congress and the president. As much as Congress would prefer to defer to the president, in a sense, some believe, said, okay, two can play this game. We're going to send it right back. I'm going to send this right back to you, and let's see what you say.
All right, and let's hear what our listeners have to say, and then we'll talk some more. Our number for you to join us in the exchange as we try to untangle this idea of who has what authority when it comes to taking military action, why Congress seems to have, in recent years, given most of that authority over to the Oval Office. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And first up is Bob in Newmarket. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm wondering if your speakers could comment a bit on what might be a correlation between the tension they're describing between executive and Congress and the fact that we have an all-volunteer army and not the draft any longer. There's a very interesting new book out by a professor at Boston University on how the army, and in fact, really has been failed, and the country's been failed, by not having that responsibility more widely spread. And it certainly forces the executive or allows the executive to be far more versatile in terms of the use of power without having to go back to the Congress, where a draft would really be a grassroots problem for these representatives.
You know, this is a great point, Bob. And Linda Fowler, one that a lot of folks have been talking about lately, this disconnect between the broad American public and those who actually put their boots on the ground. Love to hear from both of you on this, Linda. Go ahead.
Well, Charlie Rangel, who is an influential lawmaker from New York City and serves on the Ways and Means Committee, has made that argument very persuasively for a number of years and has actually instituted legislation. And his view is that the costs of war are so egregious that countries should spread them widely. And his view is that the United States would be far less inclined to engage in offensive actions, even with long-term defensive strategies in mind. But let's not forget that the Vietnam War escalated until we had 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and it didn't really stop President Johnson or President Nixon from maintaining that war for quite a long time.
I think it's interesting you bring up the Vietnam War, because it to me it says two things. One, in terms of the exercise of the presidential war power, we as a country and even Congress were a lot more naive back in the early and mid-60s than we are now, given what's happened in the last 50, 60 years, number one. And number two, there are some who claim that the reason the Vietnam War generated so much protest and such vibrant and effective protest is middle class and upper middle class people were going to war by virtue of the draft rather than with an all volunteer army where the general belief is it's there are less of the wealthy and the privileged going to war and more of the working class. And so there is, to some extent, a less vibrant protest.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Bob. It's definitely a theme that's out there that we've talked about on this program before. And let's go next to Jean in Stratham. Hi, Jean. You're on the air. Thanks for calling The Exchange.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Three points that I think would be useful to enter into this discussion is maybe to take a couple steps back. One being, we're unlike our forefathers, we're living in a world where the geopolitical boundaries between countries have softened dramatically because of our economy and technology, well, the interdependency. So that's one difference that's huge from what our forefathers had. The second thing is, what does American interests actually mean? And we need to maybe be clear about what, when we say, well, we have to, you know, consider American interests as threats to our country, what does that actually mean? And the third thing that we need to really discuss, and that is, what is our role? What is our larger role in the world? As was said at the beginning of the program, we may need to redefine what war actually means, or at least reframe it.
Yeah, and some people often say, right, Jean, you know, we don't want to be the world's policeman. What is our role? And so forth. Boy, great questions. Buzz, to you first. Can we take that second point? Because I think it's really interesting. What does it mean, America's interest in the world? Everybody defines that a little bit differently.
It very much so. And there are there's the language that is often code language is national security of the United States. That's the seemingly clearest term to define American interest. What about our economic interests? The issue is always raised when we're thinking about war in the Middle East about our economic interests in the flow of oil from the Middle East. And then thirdly, look at Rwanda, look at the Balkans in the 1990s, and look at Syria now. When a humanitarian crisis develops in the midst of somebody else's war, what is our role? We don't want to be the world's, some say, we don't want to be the world's policeman to police other wars and pick a side who we want to win, but do we want to remain the world's policeman in dealing with severe humanitarian crises? That's a very complicated question.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jean. Thank you. And we'll probably pick up on those other points too. But Linda, I'd love your thoughts about how presidents and Congresses past have dealt with this. Okay, what do we really mean by America's national interest?
Well, actually, all three of the questions Jean posed are questions that require deliberation. And this is where the Congress, in my view, really has an important role to play, which is to bring representatives from very diverse parts of the country with very different views. Madison talks about this in Federalist 10. He said Congress is the place where we will refine and enlarge the public view. And the idea is that Congress has a role to educate the public. It has a role to educate for the members to educate each other. And that's what we've really lost, I think, in members delegating so much power to the president. Matters of war are not just about tactics and operations. And in many ways, particularly when you get into questions about justice, which is what Buzz has been talking about with humanitarian crises, military experts don't have a monopoly on how to think about questions of justice and the nature of power. They're professional soldiers. They're professional security analysts. They look at balance sheets in cost-benefit terms of what can we get with this expenditure of national resources and what will the rest of the world do in response to that. But there are much more fundamental questions, and that's where Congress, I think, has been most remiss in exercising its responsibilities, and where the president actually gave them an opportunity to do their job.
Well, and that's interesting. And this gets back to something you and Buzz are both talking about earlier. Thanks, Gene, for that call. You said, Linda, Congress has an important role to play to deliberate on these questions Gene raises. And yet you and Buzz have both been saying Congress has basically given these powers over to the president. Members don't really want to deal with this. Why is that, Linda, if it's so important and if the framers gave Congress such a large role, why have they given it to the president?
Okay.
Happily, it sounds like, to hear you and Buzz.
Well, now I need to give you a thumbnail sketch of my book.
Sure.
But basically, a big part of the problem has come from institutional changes inside the Congress, where members are beholden to to activists in primary elections. They spend a disproportionate amount of their time raising money. They invest less and less energy in the places where deliberation happens, which is basically committees, where you have like-minded members with a specialized expertise. And that becomes very evident in a powerful indicator that the number of hearings that happen in the Senate, public hearings and executive session hearings, has plummeted in the last 15 to 20 years. And so members themselves, by allocating their time elsewhere, have pretty much said, we're not interested in the educational, the deliberation, exploring policy complexities. We're doing these other things. And of course, what that has meant is that the party leadership in both the House and the Senate has been called more and more to negotiate with the president about these complicated issues. And the party leaders, frankly, just don't have that expertise. They haven't studied these kinds of issues. They're juggling multiple other balls in the air. And so there's been a crisis of competence in both chambers now.
Competence and confidence, maybe, that it has the ability to make these decisions, Linda?
Yeah. But, they can't make good decisions if they don't take the trouble to gather the information.
Well, we will talk more after a very short break. And Buzz, I know you want to jump in on that point, too. And then I'll ask you some final questions. We've got lots of time to take your questions and comments as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We'll be back in a minute.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama's leadership challenges at home and abroad. Then, a former Treasury official on using America's financial power to fight terrorism. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, them from Newburyport 5-Cent Savings Bank, a mutual savings bank with a commitment to community involvement, proudly serving the Portsmouth and Seacoast areas, NewburyportBank.com. And Littleton Regional Healthcare welcoming Dr. Jeffrey Reisert, internist and doctor of osteopathic medicine, to the LRH medical staff. Information at littletonhealthcare.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, is New England too reliant on natural gas? Send us your thoughts before the show by email, Facebook, and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that conversation. Today in The Exchange, the tussle over who decides to engage the military, whether an all-out war or a targeted military action. Is it the president? Is it Congress? How have they worked this out over the years? And why has Congress, in general, in recent years, given most of that power over to the Oval Office? Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Linda Fowler, Buzz Scher, just before the break, Buzz, Linda was talking about answering my question as to, okay, you both have said Congress basically handed this over to the president. Maybe they sometimes complain about it, but basically have said, go ahead, president, you figure out this military action thing. I asked Linda why. She gave a very interesting answer about the shifting politics and rising complexity on Capitol Hill. What do you think? Why has Congress basically said, here, you take it?
Well, I think Linda describes it really well. And the result of what Linda's described is it's effectively atrophied Congress's ability to act proactively as a unit and act with on principle. And so now they are just in the area of war powers. They're a reactive and defensive body. It's far easier for them, certainly at the political level, it's far easier for them to say, to complain about what the president's doing and not, and as a single entity, not say, here's what we think we should do. It's a fractured body, and it's very balkanized.
How aware do you think, Buzz, members of Congress are of the war powers? I hate to use that language because we talked about the War Powers Act of the 70s, but of the powers that the Constitution gives them when it comes to war. Linda laid them out earlier. I mean, you know, to raise funds for it, to declare it, all sorts of other details about how war will be conducted.
My instinct is to say in their hearts, the only thing people in Congress, particularly in the House, care about is money that flows from the military. They don't get elected based on their positions on foreign policy, by and large. They get elected or not elected on domestic issues, with some exceptions. But they need to keep the money flowing to their district for military projects. So to that extent, a bit cynically, that's what they care about. And that is only somewhat related to the more significant war powers issue.
Wow. What do you think about that, Linda? You've looked at this, I'm sure.
Well, yeah. And the two major oversight groups of lawmakers who are responsible for overseeing war powers are the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, and in the Senate, the Foreign Relations Committee, and in the House, a comparable committee. And the Armed Services Committees are unabashedly more interested in the domestic impacts of spending and have typically kind of reacted when the president seems to be jeopardizing the security of the military. That's when they get into the act. The House and Senate committees that deal with diplomacy and statecraft are much more interested in debating opposing points of view. They're highly partisan committees. And so the two major actors, sets of actors in the Congress, neither of them is really charged with kind of this overview of foreign policy in terms of, well, what is the national interest here and you know, how far should we be prepared to go? And that's part of the fragmentation of Congress that's always been a problem. But it's been exacerbated in recent years by the polarization between the Democratic and Republican parties, particularly on debating diplomacy. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee is extraordinarily polarized. It also has been attracting people who are ideologues who haven't served on the committee for very long. But I think there's one key point we need to remember. There's been huge turnover in Congress since the 2001 election. There are very few people left in the House or Senate who remember the 80s when Congress was challenging Ronald Reagan, the 90s when Congress was challenging Bill Clinton. For them, post 9/11 presidency is the new normal. And they really have very little recollection of time when there were members of Congress who were leaders in foreign policy and in defense issues, people like Sam Nunn, Barry Goldwater. So they can't even imagine what a more assertive Congress would be like.
So this tendency, Linda, you know, that everybody talks about since World War II for Congress to pull back from its own war powers has been exacerbated in the last 15, 20 years or so.
Yes.
Wow, interesting. Here's an email that came in from Peg in Concord, and I want to remind you that you can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Peg says, I'm troubled that our reps in Washington don't seem to be aware of the nearly two-thirds of the country opposed to war in Syria, yet Syria and other foreign countries hire American lobbyists to pressure the reps into going to war. In other words, Peg says, the foreign countries are forcing decisions where our tax monies are to be spent, and we, the taxpayers, don't seem to be able to be heard. Peg, thanks for that email. What do you think, Buzz?
Well, 2 points on Peg's email. One, I think that Congress is very aware that it's not politically popular to go to war in Syria. I think that's why there seemed to be a lack of support for President Obama's desire to act in Syria, number one. So, number two, it goes back to one of the fundamental issues I keep speaking to. If you don't have, to use that phrase, boots on the ground, if the intervention in Syria is simply to, let's assume it was, simply to cripple the Syrian government's ability to use chemical weapons, does that count as going to war in Syria?
Gets back
That's
to that
the
definitional
really
problem.
Hard question.
Yeah, and you know something you mentioned earlier, Buzz and Linda, I want to ask you too. This idea of okay, everybody knows what World War II was. You know that was clearly easy to define, easy to say why we were there. What about, though, issues that Buzz raises, this so-called war on terrorism, for example? Does that give the president sort of carte blanche to do whatever he wants, wherever he wants?
No.
No. Okay.
I mean, I felt that really since 2001 that this notion of a war on terror is an unlimited war. It has no boundaries. It has no end point. It is appalling to me that phrase, war on terror, became so easily incorporated into the vocabulary. Certainly, the idea of unending war is antithetical to everything that the framers expected from this country. They always felt that the source of national security for the United States, and here's Hamilton, who's often cited as a supporter of a monarch-like president, but his view was national security was always based on economic strength. But more importantly, I think we need to remember that we keep thinking about Congress as the loser in this situation of delegation of power to the president. But presidents have been losers, too, because Congress doesn't take responsibility. These wars all end up being the war of the particular president. And if you look at wartime presidents, Harry Truman couldn't seek reelection. Lyndon Johnson couldn't seek reelection. George Bush, although he was George Herbert Walker Bush was a successful war president. He got no credit for it. And of course, we look at George W. Bush, and he left office with extraordinarily low public opinion ratings and a sense that he had really spoiled or ruined his party's reputation in foreign affairs for the next generation of voters.
So it's not like presidents are thrilled to get this authority.
I wouldn't think they would if they've read any history.
And a bit cynically, Congress is just fine with that.
They get reelected.
They don't. It's the onus is on the president. The burden is on the president. It's George W. Bush's war. It's Lyndon Johnson's war. It's not Congress's war. Even though we authorized the limited action in Iraq, everybody thinks of it as George W. Bush's war, not Congress's war. So our government is set up to operate in this arena of politics by its nature, by the checks and balances. But boy, you know, politics can be as disconcerting a way to run a government as at its best it can be a positive way when there's shared authority.
Here's an email that came in from Marjorie in Hanover, who says the conflict in Syria has disintegrated into, and perhaps always has been, an ethnic and religious conflict. Marjorie says these differences have gone on for centuries. The United States military should not, capital letters, be involved. We should, Marjorie says, provide humanitarian aid and diplomatic efforts. So here's Marjorie, Linda, feeling very strongly that the U.S. should not take military action. And yet her members of Congress have said, I'm going to let the president decide this.
Actually, I don't think that's what they have said.
In this instance.
That's not what I've heard. But yeah. but nevertheless, I mean, I think what they've said is we want to see more evidence. We want to certainly Kelly Ayotte has been against this. But let's think about this more in terms of what this president is doing. When I heard that he was going to ask for an authorization, I thought, smart politics. It's been interesting to me that the chattering classes have pointed at this as a sign of weakness, that he's diminished the power of the presidency by asking Congress for its support. And yet, what it did was buy time for the diplomatic channels to begin to work. And there may or may not be a diplomatic solution to this issue, but at least the president bought himself time to do that. One of the things we should do, I think, is go back to Ronald Reagan, who is widely credited, particularly on the right, with having, quote, won the Cold War. He did this with very few boots on the ground, to use that awful phrase. There were some minor operations, peacekeeping troops to Lebanon, which were quickly withdrawn when the Marine barracks were bombed and 248 Marines lost their lives, rescue of medical students in Grenada, building up nuclear weapons close to Eastern Europe. But what's very interesting about Reagan is that he and his Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, were very, very clear that they were not going to engage in military action unless there was clear support from the American public and their elected representatives in Congress. And so I guess what I'd like to ask people today, if that was good enough for Reagan, why isn't it good enough for Obama?
And I agree with Linda. My first reaction to Obama saying, I think I have the authority to do a strike to deal with the chemical weapons, but I'm going to ask Congress. I think it's the right thing to do, was a masterful political stroke, number one. And number two, it's hard to argue other than the threat of force is what got Russia to respond and Syria to respond in the way it did and got us to where we are now in terms of this agreement, such as it is, and we'll see whether it goes into effect. So if it's an example of a threat of force being in the conduct of diplomacy being effective, then, you know, and if we want presidents to be able to wield the threat of force in the conduct of diplomacy, which is an area, as a general matter, is within the president's purview. How does that affect what war powers we want the president to have? Do we want Congress always chirping and saying, no, you can't do that, when all the president is trying to do is get people to the bargaining table with a threat of force? Once you think about the intersection between war powers and the conduct of effective diplomacy and the value of the threat of force in the conduct of effective diplomacy, becomes a very, very complicated matrix.
Well, so Linda, what would have happened to that threat if Congress had gone ahead and voted and said, no, you can't do this? I mean, that's the peril of going to Congress. They might say yes, they might say no.
Well, nobody ever said democracy was easy or that it always produced the wisest outcomes. What is that wonderful phrase that Winston Churchill, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the rest? There are risks on both sides here. There are risks that the Congress prevents the president from doing something which in hindsight it will regret. But there are also risks for the Congress authorize something which in hindsight was a mistake because it got out of hand. So, I think we're asking for a level of perfection and foresight from our elected officials that's simply not possible in this very complicated world. So in my view is that at the very least, members of Congress would have to make the case for why they were not going to support it and perhaps offer some things that they would support, which some members of Congress who were troubled by exactly the dilemma you pose, Laurel, were looking for alternative strategies. That's what a legislature does. It finds ways around difficult conundrums.
Well, Linda,
or
I will look forward
to.
Yeah, I was going to say. And I look forward to reading the book. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
It was great. Thanks.
Linda
Bye,
Fowler, professor of government and the Frank Reagan Chair in Policy Studies at Dartmouth College. And she's just finishing up a book, as we said, entitled Overseeing the President in War and Peace. And BuzzShirt, it's always so nice to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
BuzzShirt, professor at UNH School of Law in Concord, chair of the International Criminal Law and Justice Program there. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Knoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the forecast for natural gas. With its abundance and low price, natural gas has become New England's preferred energy source, viewed by some as a cleaner fossil fuel. But growing demand has also raised concerns about the reliability of supplies and price hikes. Also, there are long-term questions about becoming too dependent on natural gas. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is NHPR 959. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Grand Family State Motors Lincoln with an invitation to view the all-new Lincoln lineup in their showroom and on their lot. State Motors, North Manchester, statemotors.com. And from RM Davis Incorporated, celebrating 35 years of providing investment counsel, wealth management, and trust services with offices in Portland and Portsmouth. Online at rmdavis.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Frank Sesno of the George Washington University and host of Planet Forward, sitting in for Diane Rehm. On Saturday, the U.S. and Russia reached an agreement to seize and destroy the estimated 1,000 tons of chemical weapons held in Syria. Supporters of a U.S. military strike, pushed for by President Obama, said the agreement would never have been struck.